think chapter 6, right?
Yes.
It doesn't say chapter 6. Yeah, it does. Sorry. Section 2 has a big heading, Extraordinary Love and the Details of Marriage. I don't know if you read that. That's a good heading to read. It kind of gives you a good heads up of what's coming. Chapter 6 is really specific. And so there's going to be a lot of overlap if we talk about it too much, which is fine. I've got some kind of limited notes here in mind, so maybe we'll have a conversation. If not, we'll inch one quicker. So person or object, honor or manipulation is the title. Let me pray for our class before we begin. Let's bow together. Lord, we ask that you would use the book as we read on our personal time, as we come here to talk about things with one another, as we just mull over these things and concentrate on our marriages, that you would use it to strengthen our marriage and strengthen us as spouses. And Lord, that in all things you would be glorified. And we pray in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay, well, in this chapter, in the What You'll Learn section, one of the main things, probably the main thing, is his declaration, if you will. Even when we think we're loving our spouses, sometimes we're manipulating them. And what I would tell people about this situation, I say it kind of in a different sort of way, but it's the same sort of thing. But I have talked for years about the kind of insidious nature of self-centeredness. That it's really easy to see when you're being selfish, because you know that you're doing something for yourself at the expense of someone else, usually. But when you're being self-centered, sometimes you don't. It's just an assumption that the thing that I want or need is the better thing or the most important thing. And one of my illustrations that I give a lot is, you know, if I'm driving down the road and I don't have air conditioner or heat, I'm okay, that's fine. And my wife keeps complaining about it all the time. She just wants to waste money on stuff like air conditioning. She doesn't know how hard I work for this money. And I mean, yes, I bought a new iPhone, but I need it for work. The old one's fine, but this is so much better, you know. And it's just, it's not that I'm being selfish and saying, I don't think she deserves it, she's not a good wife, or she's just being, you know, she doesn't need it, or she doesn't, or I want what I want more. It's the thought, you really think that what you want is right, and the situation is better, you know, and you see it through the lens of what's good for yourself. Not because you're thinking that way, but because you're just self-centered, you're focused on yourself. That's kind of what we're seeing here. The illustrations in here, one of them, it really points to the fact that the guy in the illustration is having to recognize that he's manipulating. Like, he doesn't understand that's what he's doing. Because he's self-centered, he's focused on himself. Without, you know, I'm gonna split hairs here, but I think it is a distinction. Without being selfish in the sense that he thinks he's doing it because he loves his wife, right? And so he thinks, I'm doing great. So, all right, let's kind of start from the front. We're going to walk through the text, I think, if we want to, we can. I'm just going to walk through the book. I haven't done this before, but we're going to do it tonight. So, loving versus manipulating, that's kind of the theme of the book, or of the chapter, rather. So, loving versus manipulating, honor versus manipulating, something like that. So, I have a little book here with a line down the middle, and I put loving on one side, manipulation on the other side. And there's things, you know, when we're relating to our spouses, things look like one or the other. So, loving is something we do for them. Manipulation, something I do for me. This is not all across the board, of course. There's gray area here. Come on in. So, the other big point he makes is that the difference between loving and manipulating. Loving sees that your spouse as a person, and manipulation sees them as an object, right? Something for you to have, keep, and benefit from, and use. Manipulation. giving to get, right? Punishing, showing favoritism, going on down the list. So, did y'all read the, I won't make you raise your hands. There's an illustration here of this guy, Howard, who is realizing that he's being manipulative, and he tells a story about this little lady in front of him at the grocery store who's didn't have enough change, and she's going to have to like go to her car or something like this, and he just leans over and hands her $1 and says, "Don't worry about it," you know. And the therapist, the author in this case, is saying, "Man, you've learned something, you've grown." And he's like, "No, actually, I realized that I was just doing that to get her out of the way because she was slow, and I wanted to get through the line." And you know, it's a great illustration because it's kind of harmless. He didn't do anything harmful to the lady or anything, but it does, you know, demonstrate the heart attitude of what was happening. If he had wanted to, he could have accepted the praise and even, you know, in his own heart, you know, thought, "I'm such a good person," you know, but he recognized what he was doing. It was really just expedient. And it really isn't wrong to do that, I don't think. Everybody wins. But it isn't love, right? That he can't pass it off as saying, "I was doing this for her. Like, I was really doing it for me. It just so happens to help her out too." We all win here. But the problem was he was looking at his own marriage thinking, "I'm doing the kind of thing for my wife. I'm loving her." When really he was trying to get something from it. And in this case, what I want to say about this chapter is this, to me, it's not extreme like the worst case scenario in the marriage, the most horrible it can be. But it is a little on the extreme. So if you've read the chapter and you don't find yourself like squarely in this camp doing what Howard did, you know, manipulating your spouse, trying to get, give to get, I don't want you to think like, "Well, this is not for me." Because I want us to be introspective. I want us to think about ourselves and evaluate how you might be doing this, even in subtle ways. Not because you're a terrible person and you're going to ruin your marriage necessarily, but just because it's in all of us to do this. We all, at some level, do that. We're all a little bit give to get, manipulating. And we also really just need to recognize when we're, well, if we think we're loving our spouse doing something and we're not, I wouldn't want to know. You know, if you're thinking about it that way, looking. So, the many categories are here. There's more than E even mentions. But I want us to kind of talk about some of these things. So, on page 78, he says, Howard is much like all of us. He was simply giving to get. And he goes down and quotes Matthew 5:43, and I do want to read that even though I didn't turn there. I'm going to flip there if you'll give me a second. Because I love this verse. It is a great teaching verse for any relationship. I talk about it, refer to it a lot with my kids. And it's great for any relationship, marriage included. "You have heard it said, you shall love your neighbor and hate your enemy, but I said you love your enemies. Pray for those who persecute you so that you may be sons of the Father who is in heaven." Let's go on down. "For if you love those who love you, what reward do you have? Do not even the tax collectors do the same? And if you greet only your brothers, what more are you doing than others? Do not even Gentiles do the same? You therefore must be perfect as your heavenly Father is perfect." And so, what is the implication there? I mean, it's pretty simple, so I'm not going to trick you and be like, "Oh, you thought it was that," but let me tell you. What's happening in that passage? What's the point Jesus is getting across?
I mean, there's just kind of like bare minimum love, like what faith is that, what practice of love is that you do something that even the pagans do.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's pretty. pretty simple right there. It's right on the surface. And he's talking about it from, I would say the negative point. That's quite right, but it appears negative. You want brownie points for being nice to people who are nice to you. Okay? Everybody does that. You know, that's what he's saying here. You think you have a good relationship, or you think you're doing something good because you give something to your spouse, but in reality what's happening is I'm expecting something in return. So it's like a transaction. I'm giving to get. Or I'm not giving because I'm not getting, in the opposite sense. And what he's saying here is, that's not holy, that's not loving, that's normal. That's, tax collectors do that. And in this sense, he's speaking to people who would look at tax collectors as evil. You know, I wouldn't say a profession, but profession is not well looked upon. But yeah, these are people who, I'll tell you who I could say in this case, bill collectors, right? Because actually, this is kind of like a bill collector. It is, hey, here's the bill. However much they pay you, you just need to pay us $200. If they pay you $400, great. That's between you and them. And I know that happens because I know a lady who was a bill collector, and she loved her job and talked about it. And she did exactly that. As much money as she could get out of you, she would. And she got to keep over the top. Because you're welcome to sue her for $300, but you're not going to do that. And she knew that. So, like that. But, so, you know, even the tax collectors, even the quote-unquote scumbags do that, right? You think about it, like, even Hitler had a girlfriend. I mean, somebody loved Hitler. So it's not, you know, he loved her, she loved him. It's not a big deal. It's not impressive to give when you're getting something in return. And you could say, well, at least you're doing that, and I agree, you know, but what we're really looking for is something beyond that. I'm not just doing this to see what I can get out of it. I'm not just loving you and being kind because we have a understanding, or it just so happens we always work this way. So giving to get is one way, you know, we can manipulate. And he talks about a couple others, manipulation by punishing and favoritism. And he uses these as biblical terms, so in other words, they're biblical examples of these things. He's drawing out that, the spirit of it. So favoritism sounds weird, but we'll look at it in a minute. So the most obvious forms, he says, involve punishing our spouses for failing to do what we want. So, absolutely out there. How do you punish your spouse? Not necessarily you. How do people punish their spouses? I mean, it's not, in this room, we're not going to see things like punching them or hitting or anything like that. Sorry, Jared, we'll talk later. I didn't mean to bring it up. It's probably mostly something as simple as the cold shoulder, the sulking. Yeah, I'm going to punish you by ignoring you, letting you know I'm upset and not talking about it, or maybe we're talking, or maybe it's yelling, or maybe it's, could be any number of things. In our relationship, it's one thing and yours is another, and some things might bother you that don't bother me, and vice versa. But it's punishing, and I wanted to bring up those kind of mild examples, because I think that's most of the time what it is. And we were like, well, that's not really punishing. I didn't talk to her for a day, you know. But that is the same thing. I'm trying to either show you or give you a taste of your own medicine, or demonstrate, even maybe beyond punishing, like directly, it could be I'm trying to demonstrate to you how hurt I am. You know, it could be something like that. Look, I want you to feel bad for what you've done or said or didn't do or didn't say. So punishing is a way we manipulate our spouse. I think that's a I think that's a big way. It is the kind of thing we kind of learn, don't we, as kids, and it just sticks with you, right? And I see, you know, our children talking about that amongst themselves and their schoolmates, you know, so-and-so's not talking to so-and-so, you know, and you roll your eyes on those kids, and then you realize, like, oh, adults do that too, actually. Maybe not to that extreme or that obvious, but we do it. We punish each other. Now, what I'm not saying through all of this is you're going to avoid every argument and all that, or that you should never confront a spouse with issues or anything like that. This is a common kind of way of manipulating, is what we're saying. Because you are going to run into times when, you know, for whatever reason, you're going to get to an argument, obviously. Something's going to happen, or somebody didn't mean to say something, or did mean to, or who knows what's going to happen. But you're going to. And you'll have to work through those things. And sometimes things that are punishments, in some cases, are not, in others, like, not talking can be a good thing sometimes. So it's all about the heart of what are we trying to do. So we punish, we show favoritism. Now, this, he talks about favoritism in the scope of the book of James, where there's the rich man and the poor man. And if you remember the illustration James gives, he's talking about the leadership in the church showing favoritism to the rich people and say, you know, here, poor man, give up your seat, rich man needs it. And I don't know if that's what is actually said in the church, but that's what's happening. And why do they do that? Why would someone do that? Why do church leaders do that? Hopefully not us, but why do people do that?
I think sometimes it's tradition. Like showing respect for some people, those that are closest to you, like an example, if you think like a wedding table, like you mm-hmm. sit, you know, certain people that way. So I think in some respects it might be that way, not that it's okay, but
you're so sweet, Celeste. I think the real reason is pretty clear. They think the rich man
deserves the seat.
Can help them. It's gonna give more money. Has more power. Pulls more sway. I want this man as a friend because people in church respect him. Because he can fund the building program, because he's well respected in the community, etc. And they pull weight. And speaking from somebody who's on the inside, that is what happens. Mm-hmm. You know, and you fight against that temptation, having been there and done that, you know. And there are people in the church, not necessarily in our church, I really don't think there are. But I have seen it in churches where people intentionally, they know that. They know that I'm the big dog. I've seen people pull a big dog move. I will never forget this one guy in the church I was in. I wasn't a minister there, but whatever committees had voted to do something, voted to sell the bus. Didn't want the church bus anymore, so he said, fine. He took the keys, left with it. And when it was gone, he had new seats installed. He painted it and had air conditioning put in. And did it, spent tons of money on it, drove it back to the church. And just dared him to sell it after he put all this money into it. You know, and of course they didn't at that point because they're kind of like, you're going to make this guy really mad, but you know, he just dropped a big dog to church and he did. I got enough money, I could drop 10 grand on this bus. I don't know if they paid him back or not, I don't know. I do know the bus broke down on the way to Six Flags and we had to have it towed back 2-1. So, thanks, Mike. Anyway, but it looked nice sitting on the side of the road. But that's the kind of thing that people will do. You know, there's that power play, and in James, that's what's happening. The dynamic is, and it might be traditions, unless I don't doubt that. I know there are times and places, even our church has some of those traditions where it just feels like the guy who's a banker is on the finance committee and things like that. And it makes sense to me on a lot of levels, but
I wasn't sure culturally if that was what was going on in that passage. I think that's like the lens that I usually view mm-hmm. it through. Not that that's necessarily correct, but that's like isolated to the scripture. I think I just understood the question, but anyway.
No, I think you're on there. I think you're on to something, though. But I think you're probably right. No, I think you're probably right. That is tradition, and it's it's that way because
right.
people just instinctively know who can help you out, who can scratch your back. You know, again, I remember another place where, not here, there was a remodel project going on, and this one particular person in the church wanted a specific thing, a specific color carpet. And it was not agreed upon. And she says, well, I'll tell you what, I will buy the carpet then. I'll just buy everything. And then you can turn it down if you want to. You know, so she just went out and bought it. And it's like, okay, well, I guess we can't not use the free carpet. And it wasn't an evil thing, but it was a manipulative sort of thing. Like, I can afford to do that. I'm going to get what I want. And she felt good about herself because she helped the church. But there you go. Now you have that color scheme.
I think an example in our church is like in the sanctuary, people have their spot where they sit. And if you're, you know, and that's not a bad thing, but if you're a new person, you go somewhere, you sit somewhere, people are, just look at you like, it's my seat.
Yeah.
I hope that doesn't happen very often.
I don't think it happens, but it's in people's minds. Yeah. If they walk by and you're like, that's my seat.
Oh, that's true.
And it's uncomfortable for everyone.
Everybody who knows that that's their seat.
Yeah, everybody wants to say,
yeah.
Well, that's where Brother Woody sits, or oh, that's where the Turner sit. Or, you know.
I have seen my grandmother shoo somebody out of her seat before at church, so it happens.
Which is fine, but I sit somewhere else.
She just was like, walked over her cushion and was like, you're sitting in my seat. And they were like, excuse me, that's my seat.
When they have their cushion in hand,
that is grandma's seat, though.
Any grandma.
You don't want to move. My grandma's got a switch.
She knows how to use it.
Yeah. She didn't carry it to church, though. She made sure we wore a belt to church.
She didn't carry her cushion and her switch.
No, I was wearing the switch.
Built in.
Yeah. She made sure you got a belt. I don't have any belt loops, that don't matter. Put that belt on. Alright. So in favoritism, it's the opposite, right? We're not punishing our spouse, in this case, in marriage. But we're paying them off. You know? And if this one feels good. It feels like everybody's winning. And it's not a bad thing. Any of the examples that we could come up with aren't the kind of thing that's like, you're going to say, oh, that's horrible, you shouldn't have done that. It's not about what's happening here so much as it's about the heart of it. Because you are typically doing something good for your spouse. Right? You're giving them what they want, you're giving your wife the remote, you know, and saying, you pick the channel, baby. You know, or you're, you know, what, eating his favorite meal instead of yours or whatever. It's something that's a good thing, but in your heart, you're thinking, and now you owe me one. Or, and let's talk about, you know, cutting the grass tomorrow. That, you know, there's a, and it doesn't have to be that polar of an exchange, but there is a sense, at least on some level, that I'm giving you something that you want, so I'm going to expect something that I want in return. Maybe right now, or maybe just generally. I'm nice to you, so I want you to be nice to me. And, again, this doesn't come off as evil, because you are doing good things. The part about it that's evil, if you will, is the heart of it. I'm not doing this for you because I love you and I care about you and I want you to be happy and doing it. Ultimately, because I want me to be happy. And that's the ultimate goal. And so I don't think, I'm looking around the room and I don't know intimate details of your marriage, but I don't think any of us, a lot of us aren't going to be in the boat where we're just blatantly doing that. And I know I'm doing it very often. So it's subtle things for us. Thinking about these things, as I said at the beginning, this to me feels like an extreme sort of an example of like, you know, somebody who's a manipulative person who's just thinking about how to always get something out of their spouse rather than give it to them. For us, it's more nuanced than that.
For me, like, the scary thing about manipulation is like having grown up in a past of hard to recognize when I'm being manipulated, because in some things like it's just so normal and I'm like, oh wait a second, that actually might be manipulation, like getting to the heart of this. Like there's some things that are subtle and there's some things that you're just oblivious to and brought to light. Oh, good to know.
I think that's exactly right. I think that's, for me, that's what this chapter was missing. I mean, it touched on it. And that's why I kind of started out with the idea of like the self-centeredness, which is, to me, at the heart of this, that you're blind to that. That's what drives you to do this. It's that ignorance of manipulation. Even the bad guy in the chapter here, Howard, poor Howard, you know, his one saving grace, his one redeeming quality was that he didn't realize he was being manipulative. He thought he was being loving, doing all these great things for his wife, and didn't understand why, you know, she was unhappy with him. But to me, that's at the heart of it. You know, I talked early on in class about, you know, getting to the heart of the matter. For me, manipulation is kind of an end result sort of a thing. This is what happens when you're deep down in your heart. You're self-centered. I'm thinking about my goals and my assumptions and my values and myself. Not necessarily out here on the sleeve, like this is, I'm walking around just thinking, what's better for me? You know, you don't say that. But we just kind of instinctively operate like that. And it is hard to catch. It's sometimes, even when somebody points it out, it's hard to catch. It's we don't want to think that. We want to think, no, I was doing it for you. And sometimes, you know, you're probably mislabeled if it happened, you know, if it's brought up and, you know, I'm just doing that for me. Sometimes you're not, and you feel kind of trapped. And how do I know when I am and when I'm not? And the answer to that is complicated. I couldn't tell you. This is how you know. The only thing I could say is, you know, what's in your heart is the key. Like, well, why are you doing it deep down? And are you willing to even have that conversation with yourself, with your spouse? Are you willing to consider that I might be doing it just for me? And I don't think there's anything wrong with doing things for ourselves. I think the key there is, as long as we all kind of know this was happening, right? You know, as long as everybody knows this is something that you're doing for yourself, then we can all move forward with honesty, as he's going to talk about in the book here. You know, it's a self-awareness. So, punishing favoritism. On page 84, there's an interesting chart here. He differentiates between an attitude of honor and an attitude of manipulation. This is kind of love manipulation. I don't know why I'm going to pick up on the word honor besides love, but it's essentially love. How you love someone. And he brings these kind of distinctions, how you can sort of tell what you're doing. You know, this is how you can get to the heart of what you're, why, you know, what's motivating you. And you is the other person, right? So when you look at someone and you see them as belonging to God, that's an attitude of honor or love. Or when you look at them and think, you belong to me. And this is an extreme example, but you exist, certainly. I keep saying that because he has to write it this way, but sometimes you'll read something like that and you think, I don't think that belongs to us. I know they're not here to serve me. But there's a subtlety to it sometimes when you think, you couldn't just get that for me. You couldn't just do this for me. You know, there's a sense of like entitlement to being served on some level that might be there, even though we don't think like you're my slave. You know, you were going right by the store. You couldn't stop and get this. It's sort of like, you should have done this for me. And maybe there's a good discussion to be had there, but it's that sort of kind of subtle way that we find it in our marriages typically. You're made in God's image, or you're an object. And he talks about that in here, about objectivism, objectifying people. But these are the ones I thought really hit home with me. I give without expecting a return is attitude of honor, or I give to get what I want. We talked about that already a lot, but that's a big one. Why are we giving to our spouse? In general and specifically. Second, third, I want you to be successful. The manipulating attitude, I need you to make me happy. Third, there, God is using you to make me like him versus you're the problem. And last, I'll love you even if you don't respond with love. Versus, I'll love you as long as it works, or as long as it's good for me. And I think the last three there are big, to me they resonate really strongly with the attitude of love versus manipulation. Again, there's a lot of overlap. We've already talked about the idea that God is using our spouse to make us holy versus happy. God is using our spouse to make us more like Him versus you're the problem. And I'll see if I see that in my notes, but I've got that somewhere in my notes. We'll get to it in a minute. But anyway, that is what we talked about before in a lot of ways, saying, you know, I'm struggling with this or we're struggling with this as a couple, and the problem is clearly you. Right? You're the problem. I'm not happy or we're having problems, and I checked with myself and I'm good, so you know, the problem's on here. You deal with your stuff. And if it wasn't for you or if it wasn't for this issue you were having, we would be happy. And what's funny is, if I were to ask your spouse that, they would probably say the same thing. You know, especially in times of difficulty. It's almost always we put on our blinders. And we fool ourselves by saying things like, well, I'm not perfect. But really, it's, you know. And so we think I'm admitting to, you know, some flaw, but I'm really not. I'm just saying, you know, I don't want you to poke a hole in my theory. I'm go ahead and counter that argument before you bring it up. Yes, I know I'm not perfect, but really, the problem isn't with me. You're the problem. I thought there was an interesting phrase on page 85. It talks about manipulation. You know, the difference between seeing somebody as created in God's image and having kind of being their own person versus somebody that is there to serve you. And he says, no one wants to be eaten alive, even if they're told they're being loved in the process. You know, that didn't resonate with me. I thought it was a cool phrase. And the thought is certainly there if it follows. And I mentioned to you before, I had a friend who was similar to that. There was a situation where, you know, his spouse in his view was very needy. She needed him, and he felt it wasn't wasn't flattering, because it felt like there was a lot of pressure there, and he couldn't live up to that. You know, so that's kind of what he's talking about here. But, do I have the right page number? It's on page 81. That's not right, is it? It is. Maybe not. I don't know. Alright. Well, we're backing up. I'm flipping through the book a little bit here, so we're going back and forth. As I said, this week I'm kind of just walking through the book. So I don't have my train of thought. It's a little scattered. You'll forgive me for that. Feel free to just toss out anything you want to talk about or ask about. But on page 81, he says this, the love your neighbor as yourself, kind of the golden rule command we've talked about before. And he says, you know, one of the problems with that command is we've kind of had it turned on our head where people will say that nowadays, but what they'll say is, you know, the key to this isn't the second part, it's the first part, or vice versa. This isn't the first part, it's the second part. Love your neighbor, but as yourself. The key to it is selfishness, self-centeredness, right? The idea that if you want to be a good spouse, you first have to love yourself. Now, that rings of truth, and there's some true kind of nuggets that come out of that thought process. But in the big picture, what it's saying is not, if your ultimate goal is to love someone, you have to get yourself straight. What it's saying is, you're the most important part of this equation. Like, you need to consider yourself first. Your heart, your desires, get what you want first out of it, and then move on to someone else. You love that other person. And it also stunts people's growth, and it stunts their relational growth. Love yourself first before you can love others. You ever heard that? That idea? And again, it sounds good. And because what we don't want to say, we don't want to come against it, because people are saying a good thing, you know, you should not, you shouldn't have to have self-loathing. And usually we're talking about people who are struggling with self-image issues. But what's ironic about it is one of the things that I would tell somebody who is struggling with depression, you know, a minor bout of depression or something like that, or these sorts of issues, one of the ways to help you snap out of that is to do the exact opposite. There's too much introspection going on there. Focus on someone else. I have rarely seen someone who was actually, you know, depressed, who was full-blown loving other people and caring and pouring into other people's lives. Now, you might say, you know, the opposite is true, that, well, when you're depressed, you can't do that. And I don't have statistics or anything to back that up, but I do know that that is something I have witnessed myself. And I, when you talk to people who are in this situation, they rarely talk about others. It's mostly them and me, and seeing outside of yourself. I have talked to someone who was struggling with depression, who was looked and wanted to serve others, but, you know, there was a good strong reason, the death of a spouse or something like that, but that wasn't the kind of systemic depression. It was just life sucked at the moment. So there are exceptions, but if you want to grow in your love for others, if you want to grow in your love for yourself, I would say loving others is a good way to do it. Because you stop thinking about your own desires and your own needs as much, and you start thinking about those of others and how you can serve others. And it doesn't have to be a grand gesture. It doesn't have to be, you know, joining Peace Corps or something like that. It can just be small things. Thinking about how to make other people happy. And if you think about the happiest people you know, I bet they're not selfish. I just think about the person in your life, you know, that's happy, loves life, and enjoying things. They're probably not a selfish person. There probably are people that like to give and serve others, see other people happy. So it's, in a weird sort of way, self-serving to serve others. That's not why we do it, of course. But it is funny, as you'll see in the scriptures, that's often the case. You know, Jesus said one of the most ridiculous things anybody's ever said: if you want to gain your life, you have to lose it. If you lose your life for me, you'll gain it. People to this day don't know what that means. They think it's ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense. But that kind of a thing is often the case in Scripture. I thought something interesting, too, on page 82. He said, deep down, we don't want to be equal with others. We want to be superior to them. And that's why we think of ourselves as above and beyond. The whole idea of doing to others as you want done to you is kind of superseded by this. We think, well, but I'm a special case. You know, they should really be doing that for me, not me for them. And I do think that's the case. No matter who you are, there's a little bit of sense of competition with your spouse, who's right and wrong and jockeying for position. And in general, we want to be superior to others. And again, it's an extreme kind of a word, but it comes up, you know, in our marriages. Excuse me. Sin, he says, entices us to exempt ourselves from the rules. And that's really what we're talking about here. The one I just mentioned, the idea of saying, you know, well, I'm not perfect, but my spouse does these sorts of things, that kind of a thing. And we can always rationalize what I've done versus what the other person did, because I know the reason why I did what I did, you know. And I may not know the reasons why you did it. And yeah, I yelled at the kids, but I'm tired, and it's been a long day, and they've been saying the same thing. You know, all day they've been asking for this one thing, and I finally got tired of it, you know. And so I have a good reason to do it. And if I walk in the room and you've done it, and I'm like, how dare you yell at an angel? Perfect child. All she did was ask for this one TV show to be put on TV. We think the rules don't apply to us in some ways. I think the last thing I want to mention in here, last couple things maybe. I hate that I've jumped all over, but kind of been the theme. Page 88. He asked, well, he asked a question, what's God trying to teach me? And then later on page, our differences often complement one another and help us to move toward maturity as one. This is one of those times where we pull ourselves out of our introspection, our self-centeredness. And in his case, he's saying, you know, I looked at the situation, you know, the first example he gave them and his wife, and how she was making him to be late for something, she was late coming home. And he makes the point, you know, I wasn't even worried about her because I was thinking about what I didn't have or what I wanted or my expectations. One of the things he said, what's God trying to teach me? It doesn't mean why is God doing this, that's different. I would say don't ask that question, but you're probably going to do it anyway. But it's not a fruitful question, why is God doing this? You don't know, you'll never find out. If somebody did say, oh God, this is why, I wouldn't trust it. So you probably won't ever know. But you can learn things even if you don't know the why. You can know what. Now I feel differently about this, or I've learned a new perspective, or I've gained some experience, or I've increased my patience, or whatever. We can learn something without knowing the whys. But and our differences complement one another. This is one of the things, you know, I love about Kylie is she's not me. You know, we talked about that early on, the whole eHarmony thing, where it makes sure like you're exactly like your spouse. And like, kind of sounds neat to a degree, but there's so many areas where, you know, she helps me grow and we challenge one another. Kind of expose flaws and faults because we don't think alike on a lot of things. And we have to do the hard work of thinking through things and forgiving one another. And so our differences do help us move forward and grow. There's a couple other things here that he talks about. Manipulation styles. Anybody read that? Pages 89 and 90. Right. You have any thoughts on that? Well, we won't dig into those things. There's a few other little minor points in here. But the ideas of manipulation are, what I wanted you to take away from it tonight was, from the book itself, it's easy to look at this and say, well, we don't do that, or I don't do that. You know, I don't think my spouse is a slave to me, which is something I've already mentioned. But being honest with ourselves and looking, and I think like you said, Celeste, there's times when we are manipulating, we just don't even know it. We're using our kind of default systems there and really doing the work, thinking through it. That's one of the things I asked early on, you know, do the work, thinking through these things. Thinking through it during the week and asking ourselves, are we doing those things? Am I loving my spouse? Are there times when I'm giving to get? Are there times when I'm showing favoritism? I'm just giving you something because I think you'll give me something in return, or I'm punishing you because I didn't get what I wanted from you. Even in subtle ways, we can grow through these things. So, all right, next week we won't be here. I'll be in the mountains with Kyle. We'll be on spring break, so no church next week, no class. And the week after that, we'll take on, I think, three chapters. I believe this next week. Is that right? Seven, eight, and nine. So we'll have 2 weeks to get to that one. And they're all dealing with honesty, so it's probably going to be, you know, I think it'll be a good class to have one class in that. Looking through that. But. All right, y'all. We're done for the evening. If there's no questions or anything, appreciate y'all. This chapter was a little dry, but I hope you got something to glean out of it, running through. Maybe next week we'll have three chapters, so we'll hit the highlights in those for the week after next. Awesome. Thank y'all.
Thank you.
Y'all remember we had a whole class one time in that, don't you?
Of what?
Chapter 15.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Did not know that.
We had a series on that.
Oh, I took it. Kylie taught it to me. It's a school.
Yeah. It wasn't just about that, but it was a lot about that.
Oh, yeah, hey, I do.
That's one that
did it all together
in the class.
Oh. And just sit back out.